Welcome to Meditation and Creativity, an internet radio program dedicated to opening our minds and hearts to possibilities of enlightenment through the ancient art of transcendental meditation. Your host is Russell Guest, an accomplished business leader, consultant, and a teacher of TM for almost 40 years. Let's listen in.
Hello there, everybody. This is Russell Guest, and welcome to Meditation and Creativity. It is a pleasure today to talk to Professor David Goodman, Associate Professor and Director of the MBA Program in Sustainable Business at Maharishi University of Management. Today, we're talking about business sustainability, consciousness, and creativity. So, David, what is sustainable business?
Maybe that's an oxymoron, but maybe it's not. Let's talk about sustainability first. And sustainability was defined by this commission, part of the United Nations called the Brundtland Commission. And it basically said that it's the capability of natural and other kinds of systems, cultural systems, etc., to be continued over time. It's the ability for a corporation, a community, a society to meet its current needs, high quality of life, without in any way reducing the ability of future generations to meet their needs. So what then, if we put that to business, we're talking about businesses that are in tune with those laws which will allow them to be able to be profitable and good for the planet and good for the people. We sometimes call it the three P's, profitability, planet, and people.
Wonderful. So from the perspective of creativity, from the perspective of the value of understanding over time what this is going to mean to individuals and to communities, where do you see the application of systems? When we look at a system, certainly we look at nature as a system, or we look at a local biosphere as a system. In terms of systems, what is a sustainable business?
Well, you know, there was a professor at Harvard, Michael Porter, who wrote a book called Sustainable Creative Advantage, and he talked about how businesses become sustainable by either competing in terms of differentiation or in terms of price leadership. But in order for them to be sustainable, they would have to be truly, not only if they're using a differentiation model, they have to not only be different, but the customer or potential customer has to perceive them to be different. And if they're competing on price, they have to have a sustainably lowest cost. Now, the kind of sustainability we're talking about is more than just that. We're talking about the accessing that creative intelligence which allows the individual to contact is not changing. That which is complete, we can say absolute, unmanifest, and that is connected to their own consciousness. So it's absolute consciousness, and it allows a person, as a result of that connection with that non-changing aspect, which is truly sustainable because it's eternal, and it underpins the whole universe. And it can be connected to the individual when the thought is experienced at finer levels and then transcended. And the source of thought within the individual contacted through transcendental meditation, which is a great technique, is the source of the universe. It's that same source. It's the unified field, which is the source of the individual and the cosmos. And when the individual connects to that level within himself, herself, then they're connecting to not only that which is truly sustainable, but that which is truly creative. And when the thoughts coming from there are comprehensive. What causes problems with sustainability, and we can look at non-sustainable companies like Enron, for example, these companies were only looking at a very surface level of profitability, and probably, and well, more than probably, they were cheating their stockholders, and they were cheating Wall Street, and they were cheating many on many levels. And that kind of way of doing business cannot last. It's going to be purified out. So a sustainable business has to be a business that works the way nature works. That means that it's able to operate with huge efficiencies and without creating waste. Because nature in itself doesn't create waste. And is it possible to create a situation where we're actually being ecologically efficient and ecologically virtuous and yet profitable? That is a major discussion and question. Many people think it is possible. Some people don't. For example, right now, today, for the next 2 weeks, there's the Copenhagen climate change discussion, and countries are either on the bandwagon to reduce these gases that are causing climate change, CO2, etc., and some countries are saying it's too expensive. So is there a way of actually figuring out how we can be sustainable without robbing profitability? And I think the answer has to do with really accessing very deep levels of consciousness and seeing that there is solutions, that we can find a way to...
Yeah, that seems to be very close to this notion that David Lynch talks about in one of his in his best-selling book called Catching the Big Fish. In other words, it has something to do with creativity, catching the idea that is so, if you will, pregnant with wholeness and the capacity to uplift everything it touches, that it seems to come from there, that a self-purifying, self-sustaining system is actually an insight of a certain kind. It involves creativity. Is this what you're talking about?
Absolutely, absolutely. And the human intelligence to be able to be creative, just to see what's happened in terms of electronic media and just the development from, I remember when my first computer had, it was in kilobytes, and now we're talking about, you know, gigabytes and more. So, and terabytes. I mean, we're talking about Moore's law of it doubling every 18 months in terms of capacity. So there's this huge, incredible growth. And just look at the internet, where in the first year there was just a couple hundred sites, and then we're measuring it in billions of pages that are available. So that creativity, but it has to be a creativity that is not going to be polluting. And when one is aware of these systemic effects of some of the things that our societies have done into the soil, to the air, to the water, etc., 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 we need to start purifying, and what we need to do is we need to access and have more comprehensive vision. And when we meditate and experience that field of creative intelligence, what happens is we start thinking much more comprehensively, and not just we have the ability to think in huge, wide, comprehensive ways, and also focus sharply. So we're becoming more sensitized to this environmental crisis, and it's now human intelligence that is going to figure out how we can operate the way nature operates.
Well, how do we recognize and use the power of the private sector in this way? It's because certainly businesses have the ability to lead the economy and society towards sustainability. But how is this done? I mean, how do you better utilize resources, eliminate waste? What must be done respecting social equity and economic concerns? And one of the things that Stephen Drucker was doing before he died and paid a lot of service to growing communities, and so these notions all seem to be so rich in terms of their capacity to make change. Again, I go back to some of the earlier points that you made. How do we actualize that in a way that these kinds of efficiencies, let's call them uplifting efficiencies, these life-supporting efficiencies, again, how do you deal with whole communities on that level? How does that change take place?
Okay, well, it's a big problem, and I can't give you a simple answer for it. One of the things which we have to consider is some of the perverse subsidies that exist. And I'm using that word very consciously, perverse subsidies. In other words, subsidizing certain types of agricultural practices, for example, just as an example, because we could talk about water and air as well, but agricultural practices whereby the cost of commodity is being subsidized such that you have situations where farmers grow grain to feed pigs and cattle, and whereas if these perverse subsidies weren't there, the cattle would be and pigs would be eating grass. But it's cheaper to actually grow corn because the corn is highly subsidized. And then we have the issues of the fact that, I mean, we can go on and on and on and think about the fact that corn takes a lot of nutrients, and here where I'm calling you from in Iowa, we've lost half of our topsoil. So one of the things that can be done in terms of helping to make business more in tune with nature is to understand some of the reward structures. And so this perverse subsidy idea is one of the concepts that we're actually rewarding what an economist would call an externality, something which we're not actually thinking about in our model. And as a result, we're having certain environmental catastrophes if we think through the whole thing. Another thing is actually reward those types of activities of business that increase profits through better utilization and elimination of waste, and actually provide, and also we need to also account for the total cost of what we do something. This is the concept of cradle to cradle. Another concept is really to incentivize an understanding of a true understanding of entropy, and how things will break down, and how can we keep orderliness. For example, we can take plastic and then we can recycle it, and you can blow mold it and make these highway cones. Okay, fine. So we're using plastic and it's been recycled, and they make these highway cones for construction. You know what I'm talking about, those orange cones all over the place. But they end up in
those ones that people like to hit.
Right. They end up in the landfills eventually.
Yes,
so how do we keep the orderliness high? And there are some biologists who are thinking about ways that you can actually keep the orderliness high rather than having it break down. And in our own physiology, how we keep the orderliness high is to contact that field of pure orderliness within our own consciousness when the mind settles down. And then that high level of orderliness is something which is highly anti-entropic. So we need to have people who are non-entropic in their thinking to think through these issues. And there is a growing body which is called biomimicry to understand how nature works without having to use waste and to think through the whole cycle. And so from a regulatory way and from a government way, it's going to require an expanded vision to think through, is it possible to actually reward and to maybe provide some sort of penalty, reward those companies who've thought through not only in the manufacture and the usage, but also the disposal of a product.
Right.
Think through the whole life cycle of it. And that is something which is somewhat revolutionary, and it has to happen. There's a huge amount of plastic in the oceans, the ultimate sewer. If you were to hear Dr. David Suzuki, very famous geneticist, he has said that there's not one ecosystem on the planet that's not in danger. So we have to deal with this, and it's going to require work on all levels, individual, government, community, and to think through things systemically.
So when I look back on the things, all of the various issues that you've just discussed, we can produce individuals who are more broadly comprehensive and encompassing, all-encompassing in their thinking, in their intentions, in their, if you will, in their ethical standards in terms of operating businesses on the basis of recognizing creativity is hooked into the functioning structure of nature itself. But then where do we go from there? So you get a few individuals to do that. You even grow an entire community, such as the one that, as you said, you're calling from, which is a community dedicated to some of these ideas and to experiencing that underlying unified field as an individual. But then what happens in the building of communities? Do you have to build an entire community to have these changes take place? Is there not some mechanism whereby it's not purely an intellectual exercise that more individuals start to jump on this train? It is something that needs to change deeply within what? How many individuals? Whole communities? Whole governments? Or is there maybe a more, if you will, sustainable idea of underlying change in the mechanism of having these things take place?
Are you familiar with Thomas Kuhn and the structure of scientific revolutions, Russ?
No.
Okay, well, let me talk. He's actually written about the word paradigm. And he talks about these, paradigm is a framework of reference. And he talks about, he writes, his book is called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. It's quite famous. And what he says is that when there's a new way of thinking, it's usually not really accepted. And then the research is so strong, for example, the Galileo, Copernican, etc., view of the heliocentric universe as opposed to a geocentric, in other words, the Earth not being the center of the universe, but the sun, and the planets revolve around it.
And remember, one of those gentlemen had to virtually go into house arrest in order to not be pursued by the, if you will, spiritual bureaucracy of the time.
The dominant thinking, right. And so what happens is eventually the old people's views just die off, and it could be also these people die themselves off, and then the data are so strong that it gets to a point where people just sort of accept it. Point I want to bring about, and I'm not sure how, but the concept of the 100th monkey, and where they actually had on one island these monkeys learning how to wash potatoes, and then it turns out that monkeys on other islands, without any contact, it seemed, learned how to wash their potatoes before they ate them, and even there's some examples of rats that learned how to swim to push one of those wheels, and that when they had a couple of generations learning it, the other generations, which had no genetic connection, also learned it. That's a little bit maybe far-fetched, but there is something, we are aware of fields, and we are aware of action at a distance, even if we don't think about it. Every time we turn on our radio, there's action at a distance. And the concept of fields has been around for well over 100 years.
Einstein called that spooky action at a distance.
Okay. Well, it may be spooky, but it really does exist. And there is a unified, you know, there's these different levels of electromagnetic and strong force and weak force and all that. And there is some research about a unified field at very, very small distance and time scales beyond the Planck scale. And that unified field has characteristics which correspond to the unified field that we contact when the mind settles down and becomes unbounded, when it becomes pure and simple and yet without a thought and yet awake inside. And that state, which is a state which is the simplest form of awareness, the easiest place to get to. It actually is very easy to get there, because if you can run, you can walk. And if the mind can be active, it can be trained through a technique to settle down to that field of pure consciousness or unbounded awareness or unified field. And what happens is, when we stimulate that, it's like a laser. where you only need 1% of the photons to be in phase to actually create a situation where you get the light amplification to the stimulated emission of radiation, which, by the way, is what laser stands for. And so you just have to get a small amount of the photons in phase coherent, and then the whole system becomes coherent. And we have done research here that 1% of people practicing transcendental meditation decreases social stress in terms of crime rate. And even there's an advanced technique called yogic flying, which allows the individual to stimulate and be that field even more powerfully. And 1% of the population of a system or society, we call it a system of people, call it a society, actually has an effect of decreasing the social stress by over 40 or studies by now.
So you were talking about paradigms and changing paradigms, and what I was trying to get to earlier in our conversation was how to change the existing paradigm into something that is, well, let's just say beautifully, elegantly sustainable. And what you're saying here is that there is a science of the unified field that exists whereby individuals experience that directly, very directly, and it means that an impulse projected from the unified field has the capacity to, in effect, change paradigms because the influence is not localized. The influence carries throughout an entire system.
That's exactly what I'm saying. You said it extremely articulately, that when you have people awake in that field, that unified field, it's there all the time, but right. You have to bring your conscious awareness there and stimulate it, then what happens is that it actually stimulates the field of consciousness of which every individual partakes, and that will change the paradigm. And we're seeing it now. There was a famous person by the name of Paul Hawken, who got his honorary PhD this year, and on his address, he was asked if he was pessimistic or optimistic about the next generation. And he said, if you look at the data of what's going on in terms of the environment, you can't help but be pessimistic. Yeah, but he said, but if you look at what young people these days are really passionate about, they want to heal the planet, he said, then you can't help but be, if you aren't optimistic, you don't have a heart. And I was very moved by that expression, and I see that in our students. They are more passionate to heal the planet, and they want to do it, and they want to do it now, and with the tools of the internet where best practices can be shared very quickly.
Right.
And there's certain things which could change very quickly. For example, if we can get the cost of solar power to $1 a watt or cheaper, then it's going to have a marvelously transformative effect on the whole country and the whole world. So, and that, we're very close. So I can see these things happening. I think we're just on the verge of it, and it's a very exciting time to be around.
There's one more topic I'd like to bring up, and there was something that Mahesh Yogi had said with respect to the underlying mechanism of luck or good fortune in business. And I'm looking at people who are successful. And we don't always see giant intellects in business. And
right.
We don't always see giant intellects being successful.
Right.
And so, you know, I believe at one time someone asked Maharshi this question, and it was, well, Maharshi, what is good fortune? And he replied by saying that underlying field, that level of self-interacting consciousness, is at the basis of one's own experience. And it contains everything. It contains all the frequencies and structures of all the laws of nature. And that sustains the ability to gain the support of those laws in every endeavor. And I recall the expressions on everyone's face thinking, you mean there's actually a definition for gaining good luck?
Right.
Good fortune? So where do you see that in this process of evolving new, not just new ideas of sustainability, but actually changing that paradigm when there's this shift, as you said, that seems to take place so quickly? You know, so quickly you go from peace to war and then back to peace. Even though a war may take place over a long period of time, the actual moment of change seems to be very, very fast.
Yeah, tipping point.
It's a tipping point, and there's a very popular book by that name, as you know.
Right, right.
So the underlying mechanism of this thing seems always that it contains a moment where someone with enormous good fortune seems to pull in the resources, the creativity, and the desire of so many different people to focus on one moment. I think about the Yes We Can theme involved in the President of the United States success, and think, well, what again is the mechanism at the social level that brings enough good fortune to enough people that they are able to support these new directions?
Well, I think it has to do with predominant level of consciousness. And it's sort of like, if you want to look at it in terms of a consciousness utility function. I'm not sure if I want to get into that, but it sounds a little bit too academic. But it's a dominant level of consciousness. And when consciousness changes, if someone's catching that wave and is in the right place at the right time, he or she is going to benefit. And, you know, when they say smart people, you know, what do they say, smart people think alike or something like that, they're often, and for example, calculus was invented by two people at the same time.
Right.
Isaac Newton and Leibniz, and, right. And this has been happening all over the time. It's sort of like there's something pregnant, and you've used the word you said before, that somehow is percolating at some level, some field level, and some people are attuning their radio to that.
Right.
And are not only attuning their radio, but they're able to broadcast to other people. I want to talk about luck a little bit. How much time we have? We don't have much, right? Because the thing is, you could have good luck and do bad things, right? And there's a lot of people become very wealthy, and
but I don't think it's sustainable. I think you noticed
totally,
that sooner or
totally
later.
Not.
Yeah, sooner
totally
or
not.
Later, even though someone is doing something bad, everybody is in agony watching the distress that is being created, but sooner or later, it is not sustained.
Exactly. And so Marshy actually had these fundamentals of progress that he enumerated many years ago, and I want to talk about them in terms of luck and in terms of business success. I'll just say the five of them quickly, and then it depends on how much time we have. Stability, adaptability, purification, integration, and growth. And all of them together are fundamentals of progress. Interestingly enough, all of them develop when we meditate. We become more stable and more adaptable. Interestingly enough, if you're stable without being adaptable, you're going to be ossified. You're going to be so stable you can't do anything. And if you're adaptable without being stable, you'll never get anything done because you're always moving around. So you need to have opposites. So a coexistence of opposites. And the coexistence of opposites is developed when individuality becomes cosmic.
Well, I think that's a beautiful note to end, and I want to thank Professor Dr. David Goodman for giving us these deep insights into sustainability and business. Listen in again. We will probably have a follow-up program on sustainability. Thank you very much.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Meditation and Creativity, an internet radio program dedicated to opening our minds and hearts to possibilities of enlightenment through the ancient art of transcendental meditation. Your host is Russell Guest, an accomplished business leader, consultant, and a teacher of TM for almost 40 years. Let's listen in.
Hello, everybody. This is Russell Guest, and welcome to Meditation and Creativity. It is a pleasure today to talk to Professor David Goodman, Associate Professor and Director of the MBA Program in Sustainable Business at Maharishi University of Management. Today, we're talking about business sustainability, consciousness, and creativity. So, David, what is sustainable business?
Maybe that's an oxymoron, but maybe it's not. Let's talk about sustainability first. And sustainability was defined by this commission, part of the United Nations, called the Brundtland Commission. And it basically said that it's the capability of natural and other kinds of systems, cultural systems, etc., to be continued over time. It's the ability for a corporation, a community, a society to meet its current needs, high quality of life, without in any way reducing the ability of future generations to meet their needs. So what then, if we put that to business, we're talking about businesses that are in tune with those laws which will allow them to be able to be profitable and good for the planet and good for the people. We sometimes call it the three P's, profitability, planet, and people.
Wonderful. So from the perspective of creativity, from the perspective of the value of understanding over time what this is going to mean to individuals and to communities, where do you see the application of systems? When we look at a system, certainly we look at nature as a system, or we look at a local biosphere as a system. In terms of systems, what is a sustainable business?
Well, you know, there was a professor at Harvard, Michael Porter, who wrote a book called Sustainable Creative Advantage, and he talked about how businesses become sustainable by either competing in terms of differentiation or in terms of price leadership. But in order for them to be sustainable, they would have to be truly, not only if they're using a differentiation model, they have to not only be different, but the customer or potential customer has to perceive them to be different. And if they're competing on price, they have to have a sustainably lowest cost. Now, the kind of sustainability we're talking about is more than just that. We're talking about the accessing that creative intelligence which allows the individual to contact is not changing. That which is complete, we can say absolute, unmanifest, and that is connected to their own consciousness. So it's absolute consciousness, and it allows a person, as a result of that connection with that non-changing aspect, which is truly sustainable because it's eternal, and it underpins the whole universe. And it can be connected to the individual when the thought is experienced at finer levels and then transcended. And the source of thought within the individual contacted through transcendental meditation, which is a great technique, is the source of the universe. It's that same source. It's the unified field, which is the source of the individual and the cosmos. And when the individual connects to that level within himself, herself, then they're connecting to not only that which is truly sustainable, but that which is truly creative. And when the thoughts coming from there are comprehensive. What causes problems with sustainability, and we can look at non-sustainable companies like Enron, for example, these companies were only looking at a very surface level of profitability, and probably, and well, more than probably, they were cheating their stockholders, they were cheating Wall Street, and they were cheating many, many, on many levels. And that kind of way of doing business cannot last. It's going to be purified out. So a sustainable business has to be a business that works the way nature works. That means that it's able to operate with huge efficiencies and without creating waste. Because nature in itself doesn't create waste. And is it possible to create a situation where we're actually being ecologically efficient and ecologically virtuous and yet profitable? That is a major discussion and question. Many people think it is possible. Some people don't. For example, right now, today, for the next 2 weeks, there's the Copenhagen climate change discussion, and countries are either on the bandwagon to reduce these gases that are causing climate change, CO2, etc., and some countries are saying it's too expensive. So is there a way of actually figuring out how we can be sustainable without robbing profitability? And I think the answer has to do with really accessing very deep levels of consciousness and seeing that there is solutions, that we can find a way to...
Yeah, and that seems to be very close to this notion that David Lynch talks about in one of his in his best-selling book called Catching the Big Fish. In other words, it has something to do with creativity, catching the idea that is so, if you will, pregnant with wholeness and the capacity to uplift everything it touches, that it seems to come from there, that a self-purifying, self-sustaining system is actually an insight of a certain kind. It involves creativity. Is this what you're talking about?
Absolutely, absolutely. And the human intelligence to be able to be creative, just to see what's happened in terms of electronic media and just the development from, I remember when my first computer had, it was in kilobytes, and now we're talking about, you know, gigabytes and more. So, and terabytes. I mean, we're talking about Moore's law of it doubling every 18 months in terms of capacity. So there's this huge, incredible growth. And just look at the internet, where in the first year there was just a couple hundred sites, and then we're measuring it in billions of pages that are available. So that creativity, but it has to be a creativity that is not going to be polluting. And when one is aware of these systemic effects of some of the things that our societies have done into the soil, to the air, to the water, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, we need to start purifying, and what we need to do is we need to access and have more comprehensive vision. And when we meditate and experience that field of creative intelligence, what happens is we start thinking much more comprehensively, and not just we have the ability to think in huge, wide, comprehensive ways, and also focus sharply. So we're becoming more sensitized to this environmental crisis, and it's now human intelligence that is going to figure out how we can operate the way nature operates.
Well, how do we recognize and use the power of the private sector in this way? It's because certainly businesses have the ability to lead the economy and society towards sustainability. But how is this done? I mean, how do you better utilize resources, eliminate waste? What must be done respecting social equity and economic concerns? And one of the things that Stephen Drucker was doing before he died and paid a lot of service to growing communities. And so these notions all seem to be so rich in terms of their capacity to make change. Again, I go back to some of the earlier points that you made. How do we actualize that in a way that these kinds of efficiencies, let's call them uplifting efficiencies, these life-supporting efficiencies. Again, how do you deal with whole communities on that level? How does that change take place?
Okay, well, it's a big problem, and I can't give you a simple answer for it. One of the things which we have to consider is some of the perverse subsidies that exist. And I'm using that word very consciously, perverse subsidies. In other words, subsidizing certain types of of agricultural practices, for example, just as an example, because we could talk about water and air as well, but agricultural practices whereby the cost of commodity is being subsidized such that you have situations where farmers grow grain to feed pigs and cattle, and whereas if these perverse subsidies weren't there, the cattle would be and pigs would be eating grass. But it's cheaper to actually grow corn because the corn is highly subsidized. And then we have the issues of the fact that, I mean, we can go on and on and on and think about the fact that corn, it takes a lot of nutrients, and here where I'm calling you from in Iowa, we've lost half of our topsoil. So one of the things that can be done in terms of helping to make business more in tune with nature is to understand some of the reward structures. And so this perverse subsidy idea is one of the concepts that we're actually rewarding what an economist would call an externality, something which we're not actually thinking about in our model. And as a result, we're having certain environmental catastrophes if we think through the whole thing. Another thing is to actually reward those types of activities of business that increase profits through better utilization and elimination of waste, and actually provide, and also we need to also account for the total cost of what we do something. This is the concept of cradle to cradle. Another concept is really to incentivize an understanding of a true understanding of entropy, and how things will break down and how can we keep orderliness. For example, we can take plastic and then we can recycle it, and you can blow mold it and make these highway cones. Okay, fine. So we're using plastic and it's been recycled, and they make these highway cones for construction. You know what I'm talking about, those orange cones all over the place. But they end up in
those ones that people like to hit.
Right. They end up in the landfills eventually.
Yes,
so how do we keep the orderliness high? And there are some biologists who are thinking about ways that you can actually keep the orderliness high rather than having it break down. And in our own physiology, how we keep the orderliness high is to contact that field of pure orderliness within our own consciousness when the mind settles down. And then that high level of orderliness is something which is highly anti-entropic. So we need to have people who are non-entropic in their thinking to think through these issues. And there is a growing body which is called biomimicry to understand how nature works without having to use waste and to think through the whole cycle. And so from a regulatory way and from a government way, it's going to require an expanded vision to think through, is it possible to actually reward and to maybe provide some sort of penalty, reward those companies who've thought through not only in the manufacture and the usage, but also the disposal of a product.
Right.
Think through the whole life cycle of it. And that is something which is somewhat revolutionary, and it has to happen. There's a huge amount of plastic in the oceans, the ultimate sewer. If you were to hear Dr. David Suzuki, very famous geneticist, he has said that there's not one ecosystem on the planet that's not in danger. So we have to deal with this, and it's going to require work on all levels, individual, government, community, and to think through things systemically.
So when I look back on the things, all of the various issues that you've just discussed, we can produce individuals who are more broadly comprehensive and encompassing, all-encompassing in their thinking, in their intentions, in their, if you will, in their ethical standards in terms of operating businesses on the basis of recognizing creativity, is hooked into the functioning structure of nature itself. But then where do we go from there? So you get a few individuals to do that. You even grow an entire community, such as the one that, as you said, you're calling from, which is a community dedicated to some of these ideas and to experiencing that underlying unified field as an individual. But then what happens in the building of communities? Do you have to build an entire community to have these changes take place? Is there not some mechanism whereby it's not purely an intellectual exercise that more individuals start to jump on this train? It is something that needs to change deeply within what? How many individuals? Whole communities? Whole governments? Or is there maybe a more, if you will, sustainable idea of underlying change in the mechanism of having these things take place?
Are you familiar with Thomas Kuhn and the structure of scientific revolutions, Russ?
No.
Okay, well, let me talk. He's actually written about the word paradigm. And he talks about these, paradigm is a framework of reference. And he talks about, he writes, his book is called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. It's quite famous. And what he says is that when there's a new way of thinking, it's usually not really accepted. And then the research is so strong, for example, the Galileo, Copernican, etc., view of the heliocentric universe as opposed to a geocentric, in other words, the Earth not being the center of the universe, but the
right.
Sun and the planets revolve around it.
And remember, one of those gentlemen had to virtually go into house arrest in order to not be pursued by the, if you will, spiritual bureaucracy of the time.
The dominant thinking, right. And
yeah.
So what happens is eventually the old people's views just die off, and it could be also these people die themselves off, and then the data are so strong that it gets to a point where people just sort of accept it. Another point I want to bring about, and I'm not sure how, but the concept of the 100th monkey, and where they actually had on one island these monkeys learning how to wash potatoes, and then it turns out that monkeys on other islands, without any contact, it seemed, learned how to wash their potatoes before they ate them. And even there's some examples of rats that learned how to swim to push one of those wheels, and that when they had a couple of generations learning it, the other generations, which had no genetic connection, also learned it. That's a little bit maybe far-fetched, but there is something, we are aware of fields, and we are aware of action at a distance, even if we don't think about it. Every time we turn on our radio, there's action at a distance. And the concept of fields has been around for well over 100 years.
Einstein called that spooky action at a distance.
Okay. Well, it may be spooky, but it really does exist. And there is a unified, you know, there's these different levels of electromagnetic and strong force and weak force and all that. And there is some research about a unified field at very, very small distance and time scales beyond the Planck scale. And that unified field has characteristics which correspond to the unified field that we contact when the mind settles down and becomes unbounded, when it becomes pure and simple, and yet without a thought, and yet awake inside. And that state, which is a state which is the simplest form of awareness, the easiest place to get to, it actually is very easy to get there, because if you can run, you can walk. And if the mind can be active, it can be trained through a technique to settle down to that field of pure consciousness or unbounded awareness or unified field. And what happens is, when we stimulate that, it's like a laser where you only need 1% of the photons to be in phase to actually create a situation where you get the light amplification to the stimulated emission of radiation, which, by the way, is what laser stands for. And so you just have to get a small amount of the photons in phase coherent, and then the whole system becomes coherent. And we have done research here that 1% of people practicing transcendental meditation decreases social stress in terms of crime rate. And even there's an advanced technique called yogic flying, which allows the individual to stimulate and be that field even more powerfully. And 1% of the population of a system or society, we call a system of people, call it a society, actually has an effect of decreasing the social stress by over 40 or studies by now.
So you were talking about paradigms and changing paradigms, and
right.
And what I was trying to get to earlier in our conversation was how to change the existing paradigm into something that is, well, let's just say beautifully, elegantly sustainable. And what you're saying here is that there is a science of the unified field that exists whereby individuals experience that directly, very directly, and it means that an impulse projected from the unified field has the capacity to, in effect, change paradigms because the influence is not localized. The influence carries throughout an entire system.
That's exactly what I'm saying. You said it extremely articulately, that when you have people awake in that field, that unified field, it's there all the time, but
right.
You have to bring your conscious awareness there and stimulate it, then what happens is that it actually stimulates the field of consciousness of which every individual partakes. And that will change the paradigm. And we're seeing it now. There was a famous person by the name of Paul Hawken who got his honorary PhD this year. And on his address, he was asked if he was pessimistic or optimistic about the next generation. And he said, if you look at the data of what's going on in terms of the environment, you can't help but be pessimistic. Yeah, but he said, but if you look at what young people these days are really passionate about, they want to heal the planet. He said, then you can't help but be, if you aren't optimistic, you don't have a heart. And I was very moved by that expression. And I see that in our students. They are more passionate to heal the planet, and they want to do it, and they want to do it now. And with the tools of the internet where best practices can be shared very quickly,
right.
And there's certain things which could change very quickly. For example, if we can get the cost of solar power to $1 a watt or cheaper, then it's going to have a marvelously transformative effect on the whole country and the whole world. So, and that, we're very close. So I can see these things happening. I think we're just on the verge of it, and it's a very exciting time to be around.
There's one more topic I'd like to bring up, and there was something that Maharshi Mahesh Yogi had said with respect to the underlying mechanism of luck or good fortune in business. And I'm looking at people who are successful, and we don't always see giant intellects in business. And
right.
We don't always see giant intellects being successful.
Right.
And so, you know, I believe at one time someone asked Maharshi this question, and it was, well, Maharshi, what is good fortune? And he replied by saying that underlying field, that level of self-interacting consciousness, is at the basis of one's own experience. And it contains everything. It contains all the frequencies and structures of all the laws of nature. And that sustains the ability to gain the support of those laws in every endeavor. And I recall the expressions on everyone's face thinking, you mean there's actually a definition for gaining good luck?
Right.
Good fortune? So where do you see that in this process of evolving new, not just new ideas of sustainability, but actually changing that paradigm when there's this shift, as you said, that seems to take place so quickly. You know, so quickly you go from peace to war and then back to peace. Even though a war may take place over a long period of time, the actual moment of change seems to be very, very fast.
Yeah, tipping point.
It's a tipping point, and there's a very popular book by that name, as you know.
Right, right.
So the underlying mechanism of this thing seems always that it contains a moment where someone with enormous good fortune seems to pull in the resources, the creativity, and the desire of so many different people to focus on one moment. I think about the Yes We Can theme involved in the President of the United States' success, and think, well, what, again, is the mechanism at the social level that brings enough good fortune to enough people that they are able to support these new directions?
Well, I think it has to do with predominant level of consciousness. And it's sort of like, if you can want to look at it in terms of a consciousness utility function. I'm not sure if I want to get into that, but it sounds a little bit too academic. But it's a dominant level of consciousness. When consciousness changes, if someone's catching that wave and is in the right place at the right time, he or she is going to benefit. And, you know, when they say smart people, you know, what do they say, smart people think alike or something like that, they're often, and for example, calculus was invented by two people at the same time.
Right.
Isaac Newton and Leibniz, and this has been happening all over the time. It's sort of like there's something pregnant, what you said before, that somehow is percolating at some level, some field level, and some people are attuning their radio to that.
Right.
And are not only attuning their radio, but they're able to broadcast to other people. I want to talk about luck a little bit. How much time we have? We don't have much, right? Because the thing is, you could have good luck and do bad things, right? And there's a lot of people become very wealthy and.
But I don't think it's sustainable. I think you noticed
totally,
that sooner or
totally
later.
Not.
Yeah, sooner
totally
or
not.
Later, even though someone is doing something bad, everybody is in agony watching the distress that is being created. But sooner or later, it is not sustained.
Exactly. And so Marshy actually had these fundamentals of progress that he enumerated many years ago. And I want to talk about them in terms of luck and in terms of business success. I'll just say the five of them quickly, and then it depends on how much time we have. Stability, adaptability, purification, integration, and growth. And all of them together are fundamentals of progress. Interestingly enough, all of them develop when we meditate. We become more stable and more adaptable. Interestingly enough, if you're stable without being adaptable, you're going to be ossified. You're going to be so stable you can't do anything. And if you're adaptable without being stable, you'll never get anything done because you're always moving around. So you need to have opposites. So a coexistence of opposites. And the coexistence of opposites is developed when individuality becomes cosmic.
Well, I think that's a beautiful note to end, and I want to thank Professor Dr. David Goodman for giving us these deep insights into sustainability and business. Listen in again. We will probably have a follow-up program on sustainability. Thank you very much.